WSHU's Join the Conversation series is sponsored by IKEA New Haven, the Wyand Cimbeli Group, and Bridgeport Hospital.
Mitch Albom is an internationally renowned and best-selling author, journalist, screenwriter, playwright, and broadcaster. His books have collectively sold over 33 million copies, best-selling worldwide, including the beloved, of course, New York Times bestsellers, such as Tuesdays with Maury, For One More Day, and The Five People You Meet in Heaven. Here he is this evening to discuss his new novel, The First Phone Call from Heaven, with our own award-winning WSHU news director, Naomi Starobin. Please welcome Naomi and Mitch.
Thank you so much. Welcome to you, Mitch Albom, and welcome to everybody here. And thank you to Southern Connecticut State University for hosting this event. We're going to be having a conversation and then open up the questions to you folks. So that's the format. And I thought we might start, since the book just came out yesterday, by having Mitch give us a little summary of the book and read from the first few pages, so we're all sort of setting the stage for what to expect.
So I'm already back in class, aren't I? I'll read you the first few pages of the book, and then if it's all right, then I'll just sort of tell you a little bit what happens from there. Would that be okay?
Without spoiling the ending, of course.
If we stay here till the ending, you all better go out and get some food, because we're going to be here for a while. I'll do my best to add the sound effects. The week it happened. On the day the world received its first phone call from heaven, Tess Rafferty was unwrapping a box of tea bags. Ring. She ignored the ring and dug her nails into the plastic. Ring. She clawed her forefinger through the bumpy part in the side. Ring. Finally, she made a rip, then peeled off the wrapping and scrunched it in her palm. She knew the phone would go to answering machine if she didn't grab it before one more ring. Hello? Too late. Ah, this thing, she mumbled. She heard the machine click on her kitchen counter as it played her outgoing message. Hi, it's Tess. Leave your name and number. I'll get back to you as soon as I can. Thanks. A small beep sounded. Tess heard static. And then, it's Mom. I need to tell you something. Tess stopped breathing. The receiver fell from her fingers. Her mother died 4 years ago. Ring. The second call was barely audible over a boisterous police station argument. A clerk had hit the lottery for $28,000, and three officers were debating what they would do with such luck. You pay your bills. That's what you don't do. A boat. Pay your bills. Not me. A boat. Ring. Jack Sellers, the police chief, backed up towards his small office. If you pay your bills, you just rack up new bills, he said. The men continued arguing as he reached for the phone. Coldwater Police, Sellers speaking. Static. Then a young man's voice. Dad? It's Robbie. Suddenly, Jack couldn't hear the other man. Who the hell is this? I'm happy, Dad. Don't worry about me, okay? Jack felt his stomach tighten. He thought about the last time he'd seen his son. Clean-shaven with a soldier's tight haircut, disappearing through airport security, en route to his third tour of duty. His last tour of duty. It can't be you, Jack whispered. Bring. Pastor Warren wiped saliva from his chin. He'd been napping on his couch at the Harvest of Hope Baptist Church. Bring. Coming. He struggled to his feet. The church had installed a bell outside his office because at 82... his hearing had grown weak. Bring. Pastor, it's Catherine Yellen. Hurry, please. He hobbled to the door and opened it. Hello, Cat, but she was already past him, her coat half-buttoned, her reddish hair frazzled as if she'd dashed out of the house. She sat on the couch, rose nervously, then sat again. Please know I'm not crazy. No, dear. Diane called me. Who called you? Diane. Juan's head began to hurt. Your deceased sister called you. This morning, I picked up the phone. She gripped her handbag and began to cry. Warren wondered if he should call someone for help. She told me not to worry, Catherine rasped. She said she was at peace. This was a dream then? No, it wasn't a dream. I spoke to my sister. Tears fell off the woman's cheeks, dropping faster than she could wipe them away. We've talked about this, dear. I know, but you miss her. Yes, and you're upset. No, Pastor. She told me she's in heaven. Don't you see? She smiled, a beatific smile, a smile Warren had never seen on her face before. I'm not scared of anything anymore, she said. Ring. A security bell sounded, and a heavy prison gate slid across a track. A tall, broad-shouldered man named Sullivan Harding walked slowly, a step at a time, head down. His heart was racing, not at the excitement of his liberation, but at the fear that someone might yank him back. Forward, forward. He kept his gaze on the tips of his shoes. Only when he heard approaching noise on the gravel, light footsteps coming fast, did he look up. Jules, his son. He felt two small arms wrap around his legs, felt his hands sink into the mop of the boy's curly hair. He saw his parents, mother in a navy windbreaker, father in a light brown suit, their faces collapsing as they fell into a group embrace. It was chilly and gray, and the street was slick with rain. Only his wife was missing from the moment, but her absence was like a character in it. Sullivan wanted to say something profound, but all that emerged from his lips was a whisper. Let's go. Moments later, their car disappeared down the road. It was the day the world received its first phone call from heaven. What happened next depends on how much you believe. That's as good a time as any to stop it, right?
Yeah. No, that's great.
Thank you. So, to go much faster now, what happens from there essentially is the news of these. It's one little town called Coldwater, Michigan, a little mythical small town up on the Great Lakes. And a handful of other people start getting these calls. And eventually, the Catherine woman, who I read about, decides that she can't keep it a secret any longer. And right in the middle of a church service on a Sunday morning, she stands up and tells everybody in the congregation what happened. Well, news starts to leak out. Eventually, other people from other towns start coming, and then other states, and then other countries. People start worshiping on the lawns of these people. People start bringing their phones, hoping that if they hold them up, you know, they'll get better reception. And then the media gets on it, and it starts to get bigger and bigger. And meanwhile, Sullivan, the character there, he's lost his wife while he was in prison. She died. He's raising this 7-year-old boy. And the boy starts walking around with a toy phone, holding it up and saying, when's mommy going to call us? Because everyone in town seems to be getting these calls. And so, angered by the fact that his son could be being filled with false hope, he decides he's going to set out to disprove this thing as a hoax, because it has to be a hoax, because he doesn't believe in anything. And so you have these sort of two concurrent stories where he is digging deeper and deeper and investigating and looking into this hoax. And meanwhile, the story is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's being reported and reported. And it finally sort of all kinds comes to a clash a few days before Christmas when they decide to do a live broadcast around the world from this tiny town of the actual first phone call to be received live from heaven to once and for all prove that there's an afterlife. And just as they're about to sort of have this thing, which has now taken over the entire town, he seems to have cracked the code of what's really going on. Now, if I tell you any more, I'm going to have to kill you. So we're going to have to stop there. That's right. But that's hopefully
never
bit of a summation.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Yeah. And you can tell by the way the first chapter is written and the way Mitch read it that it's sort of, you've got these characters set up and they all sort of go on slightly different paths. And then, well, the ending is the ending. But As I was reading it and sort of imagining you writing it and coming up with these characters, I was thinking about their different paths and how some are just completely faithful. Call from heaven, I believe it, no cynicism. And then you've got people like Sully who are quite cynical and sort of rational about the whole thing. And everybody in between, you have people making money off of this new phenomenon in Coldwater, and you've got the poor pastor who can't even handle it sometimes. Mm-hmm. So I just wondered, you know, are you yourself closer aligned to any of these characters when faced with phenomena or any kind of phenomena like this?
Well,
and then there's the reporter who's sort of just observing it, at least for a while, right?
Yeah. I'm definitely not that person. but I don't know. What I tried to do was examine what happens when a miracle is reported. I mean, that's one of the themes of the book. And I guess one of the observations I've had as someone who hears a lot of stories from people who are grieving, you know, I think Amy Tan told me when I wrote the Tuesdays with Maury, she's a friend of mine, and I sent her the manuscript of it, and she sent it back to me. I said, what do you think? I've never written anything like this before. Is it any good? And she said, let me tell you something. You're about to become everybody's rabbi. And I didn't know what she meant by that, but it was kind of prophetic. You know, after that book, I have heard so many stories of people who are grieving and who are at a loss. And many of those stories often go along the lines of like, well, I was in my daughter's bedroom. She died a year ago, and I was crying. And while I was sitting there, a picture of her fell off the table, and it landed on the floor. And I know that was her. She was sending me a signal. She was telling me it was all right. Now, I could bring in a physicist who could explain 1,000 ways why that thing fell off at that particular time, the ground, whatever. It wouldn't make a difference. To that person, she knew what had happened. It was a miracle, or a small miracle. And one of the themes of the book is essentially, if you believe it's a miracle, it is. Mm-hmm. You know, if someone sees Jesus' face in French toast, half a world away, it is. I mean, to them, it is.
Or does it matter? You know, does somebody have to prove it or
not? Yeah, does somebody have to prove it wrong? And so I would say when you say, well, am I lined up with it? I think I'm basically the guy who walks around the whole thing and says, well, I see your point. Well, I see your point. Well, you make sense too. And yeah, I guess if I were you, I'd look at it that way. And I think I needed that sensitivity in order to write all of these characters. Otherwise, it would come out a little too prejudicial.
Right. And you do sort of, in the end, not completely weigh in. I mean, you weigh in many different ways, I guess is how I would say it.
Well, yeah, my job is not to tell everybody what to think in this particular book, especially. It's more like, well, what do you think?
Yeah.
And the last line of that, you know, what happens next depends on how much you believe, is sort of also, it could almost serve as the last line of the book if I hadn't already had a different last line of the book, which I think is better. I hope.
Indeed. So, and let's talk about Alexander Graham Bell, who, maybe surprising to some of you, finds his way into the book as well. And that's a great little device that sort of accompanies the story through
yeah.
it. So tell us about
that. I have
that.
To say that that was just serendipity. I had already started the book, and I was already writing the book. And at one early juncture, I said, let me go see how the telephone was actually really invented. And maybe I can have like a paragraph that can sort of say, well, from the early days when Alexander Graham Bell did this to now. And what I found was remarkable. Like probably many of you, I knew that Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone and not a whole lot more, and that Edison was somewhere in there too, and that was it. But it turns out that Alexander Graham Bell actually invented the phone kind of by accident. He was trying to help his wife, who was deaf, learn how to speak. And he was inventing all these kind of devices to do that, and one of them was something that measured voice vibrations and put them down kind of through a wire that was supposed to move a stylus and create like a cymbal. And so if you went, oh, like that, it would make that sound, and you could teach yourself, you know, well, if you make this cymbal, then you're doing it right for someone who's deaf. Somewhere along the line, he figured out, wait a minute, the sound is going through a wire carries electricity, electricity can go as far as you can stretch it. Hey, wait a minute, I think I'll call it the telephone. But it was born out of love. And I found that, I said, well, wait a minute, that's interesting. I didn't know he kind of came from that way. And then his parents were deaf, too. And then the first phone conversation that was ever held was actually held between Thomas Watson and his assistant, Alexander Graham Bell and Thomas Watson. They were in separate rooms, and he said to him on this device, come here, I want to see you, which is such a, as a writer, I mean, you can't ask for a better sort of, wait a minute. So the phone, the first thing someone said on the phone was, come here, I want to see you.
This phone's getting in my way.
Yeah, and here we're talking about phone calls from heaven. So I just kept going down that rabbit hole, and there was more and more and more that was so rich about how the accidental steps that almost didn't happen and how it almost didn't get discovered and how other people tried to claim it. And so I just ended up weaving this whole kind of second story of Alexander Graham Bell and how the phone came to be and how ultimately at the end of his life he couldn't talk because of his illnesses, and his wife and he were signing, you know, in their final conversation. She said, don't leave me, and he said, no, and it was all done through sign language. So the guy who invented the phone couldn't even talk on it, and his wife never used it. He invented it for her, but she never was able to use it. So when you see that, you go, okay, somebody is like hitting me over the head saying, use this stuff, use this stuff.
Right.
And so I did.
Now, there's even though the book is full of poignant moments, and we'll talk about that, but for some reason I want to go to humor first, because I think, you know, I don't know you very well, but you seem to have a great sense of humor, and it shows in the book. The thing I thought was funniest was some of the names of the groups who are protesting these phone calls from heaven, the whole phenomenon, and they kind of show up in town and have a counter protest against the people who are supporting this whole idea of getting phone calls from heaven. And there's one group called Hang Up on Heaven, right, which I think is a great name, and people with signs that say, what is it, here now? No, here now, not hereafter.
Yeah, here now, not hereafter.
Yeah.
And there's another one that says, people who hear voices are usually crazy.
So great counterpoint to these people who are full of faith and not cynical at all.
Well, I've spent a long time in the media. I still write a newspaper column, not very often, but, you know, I still have to consider myself, I guess, an active member of the media as long as you're carrying that credential around. And I haven't always been real happy with what's happened to a business that I had great love for when I got into it 30 years ago. We've become an angry, screaming, pretentious, and opinionated lot of people. And so I decided to use that energy and create a press corps that does what I think they would actually do if something like this happened today, which is descend upon this town and begin to try to own it. And that's what happens, particularly with a lot of the TV reporters. You know, they start aligning with different people there, and they make them exclusive, and they say, hey, you know, we could broadcast this thing, you know, and you should come on our station, and we'll help you spread the message of your dead sister and all the rest of that stuff. And at its most cynical, or funny, depending on how you look at it, the night before they're going to have this big broadcast, where the whole world is watching, the mayor of the town starts to worry about what if the call doesn't come? And he says this to the producer who's put this whole thing together. He says, but what if she doesn't call? And the producer looks at him like, what difference does it make? You know, as long as everybody's watching, it doesn't really matter if there's a heaven or not, as long as everybody's watching. And
just keep watching.
And, you know, and I guess that's funny or sad, depending on how you look at it, but life is. You know, I mean, we were talking backstage about, you know, sometimes people are, I don't know, taken aback that I laugh, you know, and that I tell jokes and things like that. Because I think after Tuesdays with Maury, sometimes people come up to me and they say, Maury, can I ask you a question? I say, wait a minute.
I'm not
I was
Maury.
The stupid one, remember? He was the smart one. I'm not Maury. And even when I was with Maury, all we did was laugh. I mean, most of the time, I was saying something that made him laugh, or he was saying something poignant. I mean, even if it was like, you know, what'd you think of the book of Job? You know, I thought God overdid it. You know, okay. Yes, it's funny, it's poignant, but it's still funny. It's a good line. And so there's always a place for humor, I think, and even in books that are, you know, serious and poignant.
And speaking of poignant, there were some moments in this book that really struck me as being incredibly poignant. And I'm just going to read one little, just two sentences, where I can't even remember what character is saying this, but he says, you might think a person who brings proof of heaven, maybe it's just you, the writer.
Yeah, just narrator.
Okay. So you might think a person who brings proof of heaven would always be embraced, but even in the presence of a miracle, the human heart will say, why not me?
Yeah. Well, that's what happens when one of the people in town, tells the church that she's getting these phone calls, and then it becomes a source of envy. You know, there are a lot of people who say, well, why should she get to hear from her? And that's what happens. Just as the churches start to battle a little bit over, well, who was first?
Right.
You know, once,
right.
Like there's a meeting of all the clergy, and when they think it's just this one woman, there's five churches in town. I grew up in a small town, and I currently live in a small town, and there's a lot of little small towns in Michigan. So the town itself is kind of a character in the book, too. And the way, like, five churches is about right for in Michigan for a town of about 2,000 people. And it happens in one church. But all five of the clergymen meet, and the other four are going, you know, well, everyone in my church is asking why it happened in your church, you know? I mean, why your person? And you know, the priest of the Catholic Church, he's like, well, this is just, we have to be very careful here. I don't think we should spread anything about this. And then all of a sudden, a Catholic gets a call, and he decides, I think we should look into this. And when they come and they start to talk to her, they realize that her call, they listen to the message, the first one that you heard on the answering machine, and they listen, they find out that it came 2 hours before the other woman's call. And so suddenly, he's very proud that it was a Catholic who was first and takes total ownership of the thing. And the whole thing goes to the Vatican to see if it's actually a miracle or not. And, you know, yeah, it's a little funny when we talk about it, but that is the human heart. I mean, even the most miraculous things. Look, even when someone is healed from a terrible disease, there are people who say, you know, why did her husband get better and mine died? It's human nature. And, you know, much of what I write about is really human nature. Mm-hmm. I just try to weave it into a story.
And there's another moment where one of the characters, Jack, who is the police chief, right. And also gets this call from his son, Robbie, which you just read about, he keeps talking about the miracle, and he says, and he's, at one point he's crying, and he says he doesn't want the tears to end because that's part of the miracle too. Which, right. And that's all you said, but there was so much behind that, I thought.
Well, because a lot of times people, and again, this comes from observing grief, which I've, for better or for worse, have had a pretty good crash course in adult education in the last 17 years of my life. A lot of times people don't really grieve fully. They grieve intellectually, and they say it's better if I don't cry. It's better if I don't think too much about it. It's better if I just go to work. It's better, you know, they're kind of thinking it through. They're not really allowed. And now all of a sudden he hears from his son, and I think in that same little passage is also that he heard his son laugh, and that he realized that what he had missed the most was hearing laughter. And I think if you think about it, if you think about the voices that we lose in our life, one of the things I think we miss the most is hearing them laugh. I have an uncle of mine died very young. It was very sad for me because he was kind of like a second dad to me. And I wrote about it in Tuesdays with Maury, and it was kind of the first real death in my life. And he was ahead of his time with technology. He always used to monkey around with things. And a couple of years ago, we found a tape, I don't even know what they call it anymore. That's how long it's been, a reel-to-reel tape. And we were able to play it. And it was a tape he made when his son was like 3, of him talking to his son, asking him what the square root of 25 was, you know, because he was trying to prove how smart he was. And I just to hear his voice, and then I heard him laugh. And it was the laughing that really got me. And the laughing is part of the miracle. The tears of crying for your son is part of the miracle because he's able to actually sort of let it out. And that's what I meant by, you know, he wanted to lose that because that was part of this whole wonderful thing that was happening.
And I think you've talked about your own mother and how she had a stroke and you missed hearing her voice.
Yeah,
right?
That sort of was really, there's always something that kind of happens, at least for me, happens when I'm writing my books that almost kind of nudges me into the chair, mm-hmm. and gets me to sort start taking a particular tact. And sadly, you know, right when I was sort of kind of coming up with this concept, my mother suffered this very debilitating series of strokes. One, and then a couple weeks later, another. I wouldn't want anybody to have to go through that. And she lost the ability to speak, and my mother was a whirlwind. I mean, any communication skills that I have just dripped off of her tree, you know. And I remember as a kid thinking, oh, just stop talking, you know. And yet when it happens, all you want is to hear her voice again. And it's now been, next couple months, it'll be 4 years since I've heard my mother speak. But she's alive. You know, her body is still here, but without her voice, it's just not the same.
And one of your characters, Tess, makes that same point.
Yeah.
She is her mother who calls her from heaven's
birth. Well, I'm sure that was inspired by my own circumstance. Yeah. And my wife, during the same time, her sister died. And I really consider her my sister, too. I mean, you know, we've been married a long time, and I adored this woman. She was a diva. The book is dedicated to her, and she was always on the phone. One of these people who would constantly call and tell my wife about some sale that was going on. She had this thing. She would say, you need to get to Target right now. Someone is buying a dress that you should own, you know. And she would leave messages like that all the time. And when she died, after a long battle with breast cancer, and it was right within months of my mother, one time I gave my wife her cell phone, and she freaked out. And she said, no, don't turn it on. I said, what do you mean? She said, someone might call, and then they're going to erase Debbie's voice messages. And I don't think my wife quite got the technology of voicemail, but she thought that those messages were in the phone, and she, to this day, has never used that phone.
And there's a lot of that in the book. There's a lot of people really worried about getting parted from their phone when there might be a call.
Right.
And saving the messages.
But we hang on to those voices, even if they're just recordings saying, you know, I'll be by at 6. It suddenly means so much to her. Same thing that we just throw away. And so what I hope people sort of take out of this after they're done is that the human voice and human contact is precious. And we give it away. I mean, we now live in a society where we actually prefer to text people than to speak to them. And I hope I never become like that. I mean, I'm still sort of a dinosaur that way. And I always say, well, just call me. You know, I'll text you. And I say, I don't know, just call me. But again, you know, my mother, when email came out and it was sort of in vogue, I said, hey, listen, I'm going to get you a little thing. They have this thing called email now. She didn't know anything about computers, but I said, they have this thing called email. It's going to be great. I can just tell you. She goes, I'm not getting that. I said, what do you mean? She said, if I do that, you'll never call. And she was, of course, right. That was my plan. But she said, I want to hear your voice. I don't want to get some message from you. And now, of course, we can't do that. So I hope people maybe take that away from this book, that maybe get off the texting thing and actually, if you can't go see them in person, at least talk.
Yeah. And you have a radio show, and I'm a radio journalist. And I think we all, and hopefully some people are listeners, but we all...
Yes, clap. You must be listeners.
But we all understand the power of voice. You know, you can read a quote from somebody in the paper or a magazine, but hearing them say it is a whole different deal. There's so much that gets transmitted.
Yeah.
The magic of a voice.
Yep.
So I want to talk about you a little bit.
Okay.
Pivot away from the book just a little bit. And, you know, I'm sort of reading about your career and all the different things you do. And I was going to say all the things you've done, but it seems to me everything you've done you haven't stopped doing.
I know I have a real problem quitting things.
You may have started off doing some sports reporting. You're still doing it. You've been an author. You've been a screenwriter, a philanthropist. And, you know, some people start a career and set it aside and move on to something else, but you just sort of have this tower of careers going on. I don't know how you do it. I don't know what your thought process is, but it's pretty amazing. And you have a family and all that.
Well, there's two answers to that. One, I get too much credit. Bios are very misleading, and they list all the things I do, but they don't say how frequently I do them. Yes, I still write for the newspaper, but I am hardly what you would call a full-time columnist. That's insulting to the people who are. I do a radio show, but please don't take offense. I only do it, I have like 4 months a year off, which I'm sure is like unheard of in radio, but I told them that that's the only way I could do it because I need to work on the books. I do write books, but I only put them out until recently. This is the first time I ever had a book a year after I had a book. Prior to that, it was 3 years in between books, and before that, it was 6 years. So a lot of it's part-time. But to be totally honest, I did all that and stacked those things mostly out of fear. When I was 17, 18 years old, I was just starting college, 17. My father was fired, and it was totally out of the blue. He had worked for a company for 18 and a half years, and rather than letting him get to 20, where they would then have to give him a pension for the rest of his life of half of his salary once he retired, they fired him. And at the time, I was going to have to drop out of school because we couldn't afford it. And it happened just before the summer, and so I applied for all these summer jobs. And I worked from 6 o'clock in the morning till 2 o'clock in the morning to try to make enough money to get back to college. And you know, when you go for summer jobs, at least in those days, you used to have to fill out a resume, make up a resume, and you know how you do a resume where your name goes there and then it's education and objectives and related skills and whatever. And so I was in the mode of doing those things. And I came home one night late and I saw my dad, who's the most dignified, classy, quiet, you know, the greatest generation kind of guy, doesn't ever talk about his problems. And he was leaning over a yellow pad and he was doing his resume. And it looked just like mine, you know, his name in the center and then education, all that. And that night, I swore I would never let anybody control me work-wise, that they could ruin my life or change my life to the point that we were looking to have to sell our house and all that. And so I think I became very protective. And as the workplace got more and more dangerous, and I saw, especially the kind of jobs I have, you know, you can get fired from any of these things any time, I think I started to stack them up out of protection. And just as my mother used to say, you know, when you're born in the Depression, like she was, and you grow up, you never stop, like, taking food home with you and things like that. Even when, you know, we were doing quite fine, but, you know, she always thought like a Depression person. And I think I always still think like that. I'm still afraid that, you know, somebody's going to hurt me that way. So I never quite let go of these things probably the way I should.
But you do let go in the sense that you're a philanthropist. And I think I read somewhere that you've founded 6 charities.
In Detroit. Yeah.
In Detroit. You do a lot of work for Detroit, on behalf of Detroit, people of Detroit, and Haiti victims of the earthquake. You formed a charity for them as well, as I read. So clearly you're a generous guy, and that's important to you, and I'd love for you to talk about that, and specifically maybe about Detroit, and I know you live near Detroit, and it's an important place to you.
Okay.
That was a lot of questions, I'm sorry.
No, it's all right. I think it's important to watch how you talk about your charity work, because I do believe that charity work shouldn't be used to aggrandize yourself, and so, you know, I'm just taking a breath before I talk about it, because it is important, and I'm happy to talk about it, but I'm no great guy for doing it. First of all, in Detroit, I'm one of many people who help out. I was guilted into becoming charitable. I'd love to say I was always that way, but it's not true. When I was visiting with Maury, he said to me one time, "What do you do for your community? What do you do for charities?" And I said, "I don't know. I write checks." And he said, "Anybody can write a check. You were given a voice, and you have an obligation to use that voice for something more than just your own glory. You know, do something with it." And, of course, it was one of umpteen times that Maury guilted me into better behavior. But I started my first charity that year, and it was in Detroit. It was to help young kids who wanted to study the arts but didn't have the means, but they were talented, you know, and they were gifted, and we started doing scholarships. And then I did another one, and it was a pretty seminal moment for me one time when the Super Bowl came to Detroit, and they were rounding up all the homeless people, and they called it a Super Bowl party. They said they're going to give the homeless people a Super Bowl party, but what it really was, when I looked into it, was they were going to get all the homeless people off the streets so that they wouldn't bother the nice customers that were coming in from out of town, and they were going to shove them into one place, and then on Monday morning they were going to boot them out into the snow, and it was freezing that week. So I went down to a homeless shelter to spend the night there to write a story about, you know, how this isn't something that you give and you take away. And I didn't pretend to be homeless. I didn't, you know, charcoal on my face or something. I just went down and I told the guy what I was going to do, and he said, fine, you know, you can stay here, but you've got to do what everybody else does. I said, that's the point of it. So I stood online, I got my bar of soap and got patted down, and I got my towel and I got my bed, and we were waiting online for a meal, and the guy in front of me turns around, looks me up and down, he says, aren't you Mitch Albom? And I said, yeah, and he looked me up and down again, he said, so what happened to you? And I laughed, too, but then I suddenly had like a shiver, you know, like you get in your body. And I realized that that was a perfectly normal question coming from him. Why not me? Why am I so special? I'm sure he didn't expect to be on that line at some point in his life. And I never forgot that. That really, really affected me. And so I started a charity that I tried to raise $60,000 to keep everyone that they were giving the Super Bowl party for at least until spring, so it wouldn't be cruel to kick them out in the snow. And in 1 week, I raised $360,000. And so all of a sudden, I had to kind of create a whole charity, and that led to what's ended up being a huge involvement with the homeless in Detroit. And I run a medical clinic, the first ever medical clinic for homeless children, which we opened, which is a huge problem. I don't know how many of you know about it, but homeless kids mostly don't get medical care, because if you take your child to the emergency room, which is where poor people get most of their medical care, they're obligated to ask you for an address. If your address is a shelter or unknown or were homeless, they're obligated to call social services, and social services will take your kids from you. So the word in the street is don't take your kids to the hospital unless there's no other choice, because you'll end up having to fight the system to get them back. It'll be 6 weeks before you see them again. So we created this clinic where there were no questions asked like that, and we ran buses around to all the homeless shelters, and we still do. And it's still, I think, still the only one that does that in the country. And ironically, we thought, hey, when this Obamacare thing comes in, you know, we might not have to do this because everybody's going to have insurance. We have more people now than we ever had because everybody's losing their insurance. I don't know what's going on, but our line is out the door. So at least for the time being, we can't think about closing it. So I do a lot of that. And then Haiti is just, it's the most remarkable place. I went there 2 weeks, or almost 3 weeks after the earthquake happened. And there was a pastor in Detroit who had started a mission orphanage down there, and the word was that it had been destroyed and all the kids had been killed, but there was no way to find out because there were no phones. You couldn't get through. And so I organized a little trip, and he and I went down there, and it turned out that it was the building across the street that had been destroyed, and the kids were alive, but they were there with like 250 other people just sleeping on the ground. And what I saw on that trip, I wouldn't wish on anybody. And my heart really goes out to what's happened in the Philippines, because I look at those pictures and it's like, okay, it's a water version of what I saw there. And, I mean, you could smell the bodies, the dead bodies in the street down there in Haiti where they hadn't been picked up. And I met these kids and I just fell in love with these kids. And I started going back and I started taking people, plumbers and roofers and contractors, and we sort of rebuilt the place. Detroit, you can always find a good muscle crew if you need one in Detroit. And I took a lot of guys who were unemployed at the time. And they said, yeah, we'll go down. And I got somebody to lend us a plane, Roger Penske, who I know. And he let us use his plane. And we took our tile saws and all the kind of stuff that you could never possibly get in. I remember we landed in Haiti. It was such a wreck at that time that there was no such thing as customs. I mean, you just kind of walked to the airport. And they had a little piece of paper that had gray electrical tape, top and bottom, and it said customs. You know, and that was it. And you just kind of walked past it because there was nobody there. You know, one woman sitting at a desk and, you know, like this. So for a while, you could take everything into Haiti. And we took several different trips. And at some point, after about 5 or 6 months of doing this, I realized that these kids were still eating one cup of rice a day, and they were all malnourished. And I went to the pastor. I said, I don't understand what's going on. And he said, well, we don't have any money to operate the place. And I said, well, I've got some charities, and if you want, you know, I'd actually be honored to sort of fold this in and take over the operation of it. He was in his mid-80s. And he said, hallelujah. And I inherited 40 kids. And, you know, I've been there. I go there every month. I'll be there next Sunday. I go every month and have ever since. And I've since admitted 27, no, it's 31 new children. It's an absolute heartbreaking process to admit children to a place like that because of all the people you have to say no to. For every one that we can take in, there's 20 who come in and try to give you every kid that they have. And there was once a pregnant woman came in. I mean, she was out to here. She was barefooted. She had a 6-year-old, a 2-year-old. She was pregnant. And she came and she sat down, and my Creole is non-existent, basically, so I have to translate. So this all goes through translation. But I said, what, you know, she said, I want to give you my 6-year-old. Okay, well, why? Well, I don't have any money, and I'm living in a tent, and I can't afford to take care of him. Okay, well, but you're pregnant. Yeah, I said, well, if you couldn't afford to take care of the 6-year-old, why'd you get pregnant? Well, I was trying to get a man to take care of my children, so I slept with him because I thought he would take care of my children if I got pregnant. I said, well, where's the man? She said, he's gone. And I said, well, what's going to happen with this baby? And she said, you can have him. And she said, you can have this one too, you know. And I know that there's at least half of you, or maybe the first thought that comes in your head is, oh, that's awful. How could a woman be so uncaring? It's not true. The alternative is so awful for what those kids would have that they know. I mean, they come into our place. It's clean. I mean, it's all built up. We have bathrooms running. When I got there, they were pissing in the ground. I mean, their toilets were just four bricks. And you sat on a brick, boys next to girls. There were rats running around there. There was no light, so at night you had to go with a stick. They wiped the rear ends with stones. There was no toilet paper. You know, there was no kitchen. There was no living room. There was no dormitory. There was no showers. There was nothing. And we built all of that. We built a school. So they come there and they say, well, this is a better life. And, you know, there's a lot of... Obviously, I could talk a lot about Haiti. I'll stop just by telling you that when we take in a new kid, it's almost always the same story, that when whoever brings us, and we only take kids if there's one parent or no parents. If they have two, even if they're living in the most dire conditions, I always have to say to them, you have two parents. You have twice as much as most of the kids here. I can't take your kid. And they cry and they say, we can't feed them. And it's I wouldn't ever wish that anybody have to go through that. It's terrible. But when whoever brings them drops them off, we always say to them, don't make a big scene. Don't do a big goodbye. Don't do a big hug because the other kids will see you and the kid will start crying. Just let the kids start playing with the other kids and quietly exit. And they do this, and of course the kids are so happy to be playing with other kids because there's no play. There's no recreation. Every kid we take lives in a tent. And these tents are, they're not like Harry Bauer, what's that, Eddie Bauer tents. They're just three pieces of tin with a tarp over it, right next to another one. And there's the latrine is 50 yards away. So all of a sudden they can play with kids, they can play soccer. I mean, they're totally enwrapped. And the parent or whoever it is will slip away, and there'll be a moment where the kid will turn and look and start to wander towards the gate. And invariably, one of the other kids will spot this and will go over and put an arm around the kid and lead him. I'm getting choked up telling this story. Lead the kid back to the rest of the group.
That is
it's remarkable. And so I shouldn't be thanked for doing that kind of work. It's what I ought to be doing with all of my time.
I just wanted people to know.
Well.
Do you think about the Philippines now?
I'm going to the Philippines. Ironically, the five people you meet in heaven, there's a big war scene in it, and the little girl who becomes kind of the focus of the whole story was from the Philippines. I based it on an old uncle of mine who fought in the war, and I used to ask him, did you ever kill anybody in the war? And he said, I don't know, I might have. You know, we fought at night. I don't know. I might have. And I always thought, wow, what a weird thing, not to know if you ever killed anybody. And in the book, that kind of happens, and he ends up killing a little girl. I've just ruined the book for everybody who hasn't read it. But this little girl's from the Philippines. And ever since I wrote that, I have gotten so many readers in the Philippines that apparently I am the number one author in the Philippines of all brands and all breeds. It's nothing, like I didn't do anything, but so I'm constantly getting letters from the Philippines. So finally, when this book came out, they said, we've had all these requests for you to go to the Philippines for some reason. They keep calling and go to the Philippines. We go to the Philippines. I said, okay, I'll go to the Philippines. And I've never been there. And we agreed to do it about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And we announced it. And then this terrible tragedy happened. So I wrote a little, what do you call it? I don't know, Facebooks. And I don't do them. I mean, I have them, so I have to take ownership of them. Tweet. But I generally, like, I call somebody in New York and I say, can we say something like this? And they do it. So I don't really know how to actually.
And they say, Mitch, 140 characters.
Yes, that I know, 140 characters. So I just sent a little 140 character message out to everybody in the Philippines. And I said, listen, our prayers are with you, our thoughts are with you. And, you know, having seen what happened in Haiti and gone through here in America, we've seen Katrina and Sandy. You know, I know how hard this is and it's going to be a long haul. Please know we're praying for you, and I am coming in February now, come hell or high, well, I didn't say hell or high water, that would be bad, but I said I'm going to be there for whatever little help that is, or whatever little thing I can count on it. I'm not canceling, I'm going to be there, and I got back 280,000, whatever it is of, you know, views, hits, comments, whatever, most of them from the Philippines, saying thank you. You know, like, thanks for thinking of us, which is really incredible. So I hope that stays in the news, that story, and I hope it doesn't fade away, you know, because it's so far away, it's hard to get to. Haiti was a little easier, you know, you just hop on a plane, you're right there, but it's a long haul to the Philippines. It's 19 hours, you know, from, like, L.A. So, yeah, I'll be there. I'll report back on that when I go in February.
So speaking of Facebook, I said to my Facebook friends yesterday, not with my voice, but with my keyboard.
With your keyboard, yeah.
I said, what would you want me to ask Mitch Albom? And I'm going to ask you the question that somebody told me to ask, not because I could follow up, because I don't know, but what do you think of the new manager of the Detroit Tigers?
The new manager of the Detroit Tigers is named Brad Ausmus, and he's, you know, you're getting old when you remember when you covered him as a player, and now he's a manager. And I covered him when he was a player for the Tigers. He was a pretty good catcher, not great, but pretty good. Played a long time, but he's young, and he's handsome, and he's rugged, and we are not used to that in Detroit. Our managers have been Sparky Anderson and Jim Leland. These are guys with, like, white hair, and they're kind of stooped over, and they all look a little ridiculous wearing that manager's outfit, which, you know, I keep wondering, every other sport, you can wear a suit. Why in baseball do you have to dress like the players, you know? I mean, can you imagine, like basketball?
Halloween.
Can you imagine the NBA where the coach had to wear shorts? You ever seen some of these guys?
Or gymnastics, that would be even worse.
Yeah, well, right, gymnastics, swimming, you know. But for some reason in baseball, you got to dress as if we run out of guys, you're going to have to go in there. Why? You know? So we're used to these old grumpy kind of, rah, 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 rah. And now all of a sudden, this guy went to Dartmouth not to play baseball. He went to Dartmouth to get a degree in, I don't know, economics. His dad wrote a book on Nietzsche, and he read it. And this guy is the manager of the Detroit Tigers, so we're all trying to figure out, like, where do we go from here? I mean, he's not going to drool. He's not going to smoke. He's not going to, you know.
Is he going to spit?
No, he doesn't chew tobacco. He doesn't do anything like that. He's an alien, I think. I don't know.
We shall
but
see.
I think he'll be okay. You can tell whoever asked you that.
I will do that.
I think he's
back.
A good hire.
I'm glad I didn't have to ask a follow-up question. So I could ask you a million more questions, but I feel like we should share the wealth with you guys. So let's have a Q&A session. I hope we have the lights up so we can see you better. Yes, thank you. And there are microphones in two places, here and here, and please line up and ask the questions. Well,
right.
How about walking up to the mic?
She's from Detroit. She doesn't need
Miss
a mic.
Miss Detroiter.
We yell it out.
What?
Wait, you have to actually...
Yeah, the mic.
Get your. Right. There you go.
You got me? Hello? What part of Detroit did you grow up in?
I didn't grow up in Detroit. I grew up in Philadelphia.
Jersey.
Yeah, I grew up in Jersey and Philadelphia. I moved to Detroit when I was in my early mid-20s, and I've been there ever since.
And when did you start writing for the Free Press?
Right then.
I followed you ever since then. And
so you could have answered that question without me.
I know, but I wasn't sure of the year. And the church you had written about with the hole in the ceiling, is it still in Detroit?
Oh, yeah.
Where is it? Because I'm going there in a couple weeks.
It's on just off of Trumbull, just down off of West Grand and Trumbull, just right down the street from the Motor City Casino. In fact, the church that she's referencing is the church that I wrote about in the book Have a Little Faith, which was that church was once the biggest, Episcopalian? Presbyterian, sorry. Thank you, Rosie.
Not from heaven.
Biggest
or...
Presbyterian. You can tell we've been on the road for a little while already, and my brain is fried. The biggest Presbyterian congregation in all the Midwest. It had 50 Sunday school teachers on its roster. It had 2,000 families, but that was in 1880.
And when
Henry Covington took it over, they gave it to him. They just said, take it. If you want to pay the bills or deal with this, a giant hole in the roof of the church where rain and snow would literally come in, and he took it over and let homeless people sleep there on the floor. He was an ex-con, and he'd been in prison. He turned his life around, and he was doing the same for other people. And we, you know, I got involved with him. We created this thing called the Hole in the Roof Foundation, which is one of the charities, and we fixed the roof, which was a great moment. That church is still there.
Well, I'm passionate about Detroit,
yeah,
as you are.
All right.
Thank you for helping Detroit out. They're making a comeback.
Yeah, we're not going anywhere. I hope.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi, Mitch.
Hi.
My name is Steven. I'm from Bethel, Connecticut. Let me just say, I've been a huge fan of your books. I've read every one of them. Five People You Meet in Heaven, Tuesdays with Maury for One More Day. Five People You Meet in Heaven is always my number one favorite book.
Thank you.
I just wanted to thank you for that. Sure. My question is, with the books that you've written, such as The Five People You Meet in Heaven, The Five People You Meet in Heaven and For One More Day, those were fiction books.
Yeah.
The others, Tuesdays with Maury, Have a Little Faith, they were nonfiction.
Right.
But they have the same theme of dealing with death. I want to know, did you ever have a near-death experience? Why do all your books talk about death and the life after, or dealing with death, or the death of a loved one?
Right. Well, no, I haven't had any near-death experiences. And I always sort of take a little disagreement with, and I'm sure you don't mean it in a negative way, but sometimes people say, oh, you're always writing about death, and I say, no, I don't. People who write about serial killers write about death. People who write crime things write about death. People who write about getting your throat slashed and the heart came out and the blood was all over the body and that's death. I don't ever write about that. In my books, usually there's one person who dies. It's usually at the very beginning or at the very end. And the rest of the book is just about life. It's just about how to live it, being aware that it doesn't go on forever. But frequently, you can't really talk about the kinds of things I like to talk about or the themes I do unless you accept that life isn't going to go on forever. So I don't have some morbid fascination with death in any way. So it just seems like if you're going to write about things that are about the preciousness of life or about having another day with somebody who you miss or what heaven might be like, whatever, death is like the mirror that you hold up for the reader to say, listen, here's why you might want to read this story, because believe it or not, there's going to come a day for you too, you know. We all, my generation anyhow, or probably anyone younger, we all think we're going to live forever, you know. I mean, we just don't actually accept. We keep thinking they're going to invent something. Just got to live long enough and they're going to invent something. But I don't think it's going to happen. So I don't know. I don't have any... You know, it wasn't like I almost got killed and now I'm writing these books. These are the stories that come out of me. I mean, sometimes I say, well, if John Grisham were sitting here, would you say, so this whole lawyer thing, you know? Every book, a lawyer. Why? You know? Because that's what he does. He's good at it. So. I hope that answers your question.
I just have one more question. This is going to make you laugh. I feel like we need a laugher after that question. In the film adaptations of Tuesdays with Morrie and Have a Little Faith, in Tuesdays with Morrie, you were played by Hank Azaria.
Right.
And I'm drawing a blank. Who was the other
Brad
actor?
Whitford.
What?
Brad Whitford. Yeah.
Who was your favorite Mitch Albom portrayer?
They were both great guys. First of all, they both remain friends. In fact, I'm seeing Brad on Sunday in L.A. where he's hosting an event where we're going to do what we're doing here, and he's going to be you. And I asked him if he would do it as a favor, and he said, ooh. He says, yeah, just come out here. You're going down, bitch. Yeah. So he's a very, very funny guy, and so is Hank. But I always just teased Hank, and then I teased Brad Whitford. I said, so one day you're going to be in an old age home for actors, you know, and the guy to your left is going to say, I played Othello. And the guy on the right is going to say, I played Hamlet. And you'll be that guy in the middle saying, I played Mitch Albom. So I always feel sorry for them. But I don't have a favorite. They were both great, and they're wonderful guys. And I'm happy that I've remained friends with both.
Thank you very much. You're welcome. I'm looking forward to reading The First Phone Call from Heaven.
Thank you. Thank you for coming out here tonight.
Hi, my name is Evie. I'm from Westport, Connecticut.
Hey, Evie.
And my sister and I share something interesting we just realized, and that's both of our favorite authors. In fact, she teaches the five people you meet in heaven to high school sophomores in Toms River, New Jersey. Mm. And she would love to be here today. She's insanely jealous, but I did say that I would ask a question if she had one. Her question is whether, how did you come to spirituality in your life? Was it something having to do with Maury Schwartz, or was it before that? And that's a question for Mary.
Well, I mean, I was raised with a lot of religion. I ended up going to a religious school from the time I was 11 to the time I graduated high school, with the exception of 1 year. Not so much because my parents were big on that, but because the education system where we lived wasn't particularly good, and the public schools weren't pretty good, and I was like bored. I was one of those kids that was wandering around. You know, they had to give me like a special little box of cards to do my own program because I was, you know, I wasn't connecting, I guess, with what they were teaching. So I got sent to this religious academy, and it was a Jewish school, and the first 3 hours of the day was all taught in Hebrew, you know, and I mean, not only did I study every book of the Bible backwards and forwards and all the commentary on it, I used to be able to read Sanskrit, you know, some of those old commentaries. They made us learn how to do that, which really comes in handy later in life, let me tell you. Every now and then, you open the box and the directions are in Sanskrit, and you say, I got this one, yeah. Here, give me this. It says 2 AA batteries. So I had a real heavy indoctrination of religion when I was younger. But then I really, to be honest with you, I walked away from it. I went to college, and once I got out of college, I just had nothing to do with it for years. And probably seeing Maury again, and I became much more spiritual, not so much religious, but spiritual. And when Maury, I asked, Maury had been like an atheist or an agnostic, or whatever you wanted to call it. But then in the last couple weeks, he said, I think I'm having a change of heart, you know. And so I've seen that happen a lot, actually. And I think that sort of nudged me down the path. And then getting involved with the church in Detroit and then writing this book about Have a Little Faith, where I went back to my childhood rabbi and ended up spending 8 years with him trying to write his eulogy. You know, he came to me asking me to write his eulogy in the year 2000. He didn't die till 2008. I mean, talk about early planning, you know. But he and I became very close, and I have to say I've fallen in love with faith as I've gotten older. Maybe because you need it more, you know, maybe because more people die in your life or whatever, but all faith is beautiful to me, you know, all of it. I'm not a person who discriminates. I'm married to a very devout Christian. My simple philosophy is some faith is better than none, And as long as it's not hurting somebody, and as long as it's not faith that says, we're right, you're wrong, you die, which is not faith, it's hate, I encourage it. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Thank you.
Hi, Mitch.
Hi.
I'm Adam. Your books have inspired a lot of people, and I'm just curious as to what inspires you, and specifically what motivated you to choose the premise that you used for this book.
For this one?
Yeah.
Probably, like I said before, the preciousness of the human voice and the fact that, you know, we really wish we could have it when we lose it. And, you know, I think what happened with my mom, what happened with my sister-in-law, probably the big motivation for this one here.
Have you ever gotten a phone call?
Not yet. But my line is open.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi, Mitch. You just stole my question.
That's okay.
Your subject matter is on living and dying, and now with this latest one with the phone call from heaven in the hereafter. And I was wondering if you have ever been contacted by a deceased, for example, Maury. Has he ever let you know that he's all right?
No, but, I mean, I have a lot of dreams, and, you know, I think dreams are where you, most people sort of have that kind of contact, or you know, not that many people actually get a phone call or hear voices, but I'll tell you something that's funny that my wife told me, and I didn't, now my wife is, she believes that she gets, you know, she has a different sense about her, and she told me a few years ago that she woke up in the middle of the night, and she saw, and she swears. Now, I couch this by saying that my wife frequently wakes up in the middle of the night, but she's not awake, and she says things like, oh, oh, and I go, what, what? She goes, there's a mouse running across the ceiling. And, you know, at the beginning, I go, where? God, where? And then I realize mice really can't run across the ceiling. And she's just having this sort of, I'm awake, but I'm kind of hallucinating thing. And so I now just lie there like this, because it's always like 3 in the morning, and I go, wait, I see it. I got it. She goes, do you have it? I go, yeah, I got it. She goes, throw it out. Okay, I'm throwing it out. I never move, you know. I'm throwing it out. Now, sometimes I turn my voice away to make it sound a little more realistic, you know. I'm in the bathroom. I'm throwing it out. Okay, honey.
Would
it's
she
all
be
right
like
now.
Really pleased to hear that you're telling this story?
Oh, she does. Yeah, well, she's not here now. That's okay. But and then she goes right back to sleep and doesn't remember anything. One time, okay, it's a little blue, but one time she popped up and she went, I forgot my lunch money. Shit. And then she went right back to sleep. And I couldn't go back to sleep after. I was laughing so hard. And when we got up the next morning, I said, do you remember anything about last night? She said, what, what? I said, did you ever have a dream about being like in kindergarten? Why? I said, because you said you forgot your lunch money. She said, oh, yeah, I was kind of dreaming about that. I said, okay. But to answer your question.
What was
in
the question?
A more serious way. Well, there is a point to this. She told me a few years ago, just so you know that she's not the butt of this whole story, I am. She told me a few years ago that she woke up, she heard something, and she woke up and she looked over at me, and there was an old, I get goosebumps when I tell this, there was an old version of myself hovering over me and yelling at me and screaming at me, furious at me, like lecturing me over something. And not long after that, something really bad happened that was a mistake of mine, you know, that, you know, just how I had been leading my life. And I always wonder if that was, you know, and she said, I think that that was, you know, your older thing came back and was warning you, don't be this way. So, I don't know, I haven't had any of those kind of experiences, but I know people who I respect or love who have, so. All right?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi, I'm Abby. I actually just recently started reading your books. I read The Timekeeper actually just recently for my school book club, and it was really interesting, and I really want to be a writer. It's like one of the only things that I really, really love to do, and I was wondering what your first job in the media business was.
First job in media, I volunteered for a local newspaper in New York. I was a musician. That's all I ever wanted to be. I didn't train for writing. I never had any classes in it. I never wrote anything for my high school newspaper, my college newspaper. So anybody who tells you, how old are you?
I'm 16.
Okay. Anybody who tells you, like, if you haven't started writing yet, you're too far behind, don't listen to them. I didn't start writing anything until I was about 23 years old. And I volunteered for a local newspaper that they gave out in the supermarket because I was a musician. I was working at night, so I have time during the day. And I had a little ad like, if you have time, we can use some help. And I went in to this office. I was like the youngest person who was doing anything there by 30 years. And I said, well, I can do something. And they said, well, we have a story we need somebody to cover. Now, I mean, I'd never written a story. I never did anything journalism. I said, yeah, okay, I can do that. Because I had seen All the President's Men, so whatever. I knew how it worked. You get a pad and you get a pen and you go and you ask a lot of hard questions. So they assigned me to parking meters. They had a meeting of the whatever little committee in town in Flushing, New York, was deciding the price of parking meters, if there's going to be 5 cents or 10 cents. And I went to the meeting, and I asked a lot of really hard questions. Why 5 cents? Why 10 cents? And then I wrote a story based on total imitation. I mean, I had no idea. So I read a lot of newspapers, and, you know, it's like that first paragraph kind of tells you what it is, and the second paragraph, like, tells you a little bit more, and the third one has a quote. So I just did that, and I gave it to them, and then I came back to the supermarket the next week, and I picked it up like I did every week, and there was my story on the bottom of the front page, which shows you what kind of news week it was. And I think that moment when I saw my name and, you know, something written underneath it was when I fell in love with, you know, the whole idea of being able to create through writing. And I worked there for like 8 or 9 months for no money. And I never took a penny, but I did everything. And eventually they said, you know, you're around here like 60 hours a week. We're gonna offer you a job. We're gonna pay you $25 a week. And I said, better not quit that piano playing job I got. And I did that. I worked during the day there. At night, I played in dive bars and things like that. And eventually, I went back to grad school and started. So that was my first job, was for free.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi, Mitch. It's an honor to meet you.
Oh, thank you.
You can say this is a meeting. My name is Tamar, and I actually work with inner-city children in New Haven at a place called Clifford Beers Clinic, so I really appreciate the work that you're doing in Haiti and elsewhere. The question that I have for you is, ever since I read your book, Tuesdays with Maury, I've been wondering if you have some advice about how to cultivate that kind of relationship with somebody, you know, whether it's just to kind of talk to them, interview them about their life, or even possibly to write about it, or, you know, like you did, to publish it and share it with the world.
Well, I have to tell you that Tuesdays with Maury, I didn't go hang out with Maury or visit him because I thought there was a book in it. You know, and I think that would be a mistake. You know, there was a whole backstory with me and Maury. I mean, we had been very, very close during college. I took every class he offered. I majored in sociology on account of him. I didn't even care about sociology. I just had so many credits, it would have been a shame to waste them, you know. You know, we ate meals together, we hang around campus together. I mean, he was more like an uncle to me, and that was why it was such a shame for me to do what I did, which I, to this day, am ashamed of, you know, that I went off 16 years and didn't contact him. So when I got back together with him and I was visiting with him, it was much more about reconnecting and finding out who I was and talking to him than anything having to do with the book. But I think that, boy, most older people and most ill people that I know would love to have someone come and talk to them. Love it. And, you know, there's one point that I said to Maury when I first bought a tape recorder after like 3 or 4 weeks, and, you know, I just felt weird even turning it on, and I turned it on, and I asked him a couple questions, and then I said, this is weird. You know, we don't have to do this. And he said, no, I want somebody to hear my story. I want to tell you my story. And I think that that's true of a lot of people, particularly when they're facing immortality. So I think if you gain their confidence or if you know them already and you just say, well, listen, let's talk about it, break it down, you know, have a little plan, I have a blueprint, you know, let's talk about your early years, let's talk about your childhood, what did you learn from there, but eventually, work, you know, don't just start talking about, like, what's it like to be terminally ill. That's kind of a, you know, tough way to begin. But I think most people, you know, the most seductive question in journalism is always, I want to hear your story. So I think most people would want to do it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi, my name's Lindsay, and going on what you were saying about the tape recorders with Maury, do you ever find yourself going back and listening to those and either consciously or subconsciously writing Maury in as characters into your books?
I don't do the latter. I wrote everything I wanted to say about my relationship with Maury, and he was very distinct, and I think I'm very careful not to recreate a Maury. In fact, if you look at The Five People You Meet in Heaven, the protagonist of that is a guy who basically doesn't speak at all, Eddie. You know, all he says is, hmm. I never been nowhere, they didn't ship me with a rifle. You know, that was the kind of thing that my Uncle Eddie said. So I really went the opposite direction. As far as listening to his tapes, sure, of course. I hear him sometimes, even if I can't help it, you know, they run a retrospective on television of his Nightline tapes and things like that. And he sounds the same to me as he does in my head. And I remember everything that he said. And I am constantly repeating the lines that he said to me. And he had a very high-pitched kind of, oh, oh, yeah. He said to me at the end, I've been telling this story because it's one of the underpinnings of this book, the last visit I had with him. He said, I want to ask you a favor. I said, okay. He said, well, after I'm dead, come to my grave. I said, okay, well, not the way everybody else is going to come. Don't leave the car running. Get out, put down some flowers, get back in the car, drive away. Don't do that. Bring a blanket. Bring some sandwiches. And I want you to talk to me. I said, wait a minute. You want me to come to the cemetery, have a picnic at your tombstone, and talk to the air? Exactly. Just like we're talking now. I said, well, Maury, it's not going to be like we're talking now because you won't be able to talk back. Smile. Well, Mitch, I'll make you a deal. After I'm dead, you talk, I'll listen. But that whole relationship, you know, being able to talk to people after you're gone, that came really, that's, you know, the backdrop of the first phone call story. So yes, he's constantly in my head, and I hear his tapes, but he's not recreated, and there won't ever be a Wednesdays with Maury or Friday. You know, that's what they all wanted after Tuesdays with Maury. They wanted, you know, chicken soup with Maury and Venus and Mars and Maury.
Idiot's Guide to Maury.
Idiot's Guide to Maury. Or my favorite, you know, Things Maury Told Me, but I forgot to put in the first book.
How about two more questions? Is that good with you?
Oh, I can do whatever you like. I have nowhere to go. I'm sleeping in New Haven tonight. So.
Okay, two more questions.
Hi.
Hi.
My name's Charles.
Hi, Charles.
It's a great honor to meet you. I've read three of your books, and you know, I personally have been around the country as I'm sure you have. I was brought up in L.A. I lived for 5 years in Chicago. I've visited New York. Honestly, I prefer Chicago. But my question to you is, what exactly are some of the things that draws you to Detroit, of all places?
Besides my mortgage. I'm actually glad you asked me that, because Detroit has taken quite a beating, both economically and socially and everything over the course of the last 7 or 8 years. But as bad as that has been, the beating that it's taken by the national media, who seem to love to drop in, we call it the death and destruction tour. They land at Metro Airport, they drive out to the Packard plant, which has been closed for 30 years, and they go take pictures about the stalagmites hanging from the ceiling or whatever they're called. And then they go down to Brightmoor, is our worst neighborhood, and they take pictures of the burned out houses that are there, and then they find some out of work auto worker hanging out the back of the bar, and they get back on the plane and they drive home and they write the decay of a Rust Belt city story. But that's not my city, and it's not what Detroit is. And there are great people there who are working and trying to rebuild that place and bouncing back. And, you know, these are people who worked 20, 30 years for a factory, for an auto factory, and were promised that they would be taken care of for the rest of their life with health care and things like that. And all of a sudden, it's just, well, city's bankrupt. We're going to take it away from you. And yet they stay there. And they fight back, and they value family, and they value hard work, and they value honesty. And these are all great reasons to live there. And, I remember when I first arrived in Detroit, there was a letter sitting in my mailbox at the Free Press. I hadn't written anything yet. I hadn't even written a column. They had just written a story about me coming. And there was a letter already in my box, and I opened it up. It was from a couple outside of Detroit, and they said, hey, we read about you coming, and we wanted to welcome you to Detroit. And, we hope you enjoy your time here. We know you won't stay because none of the good ones do. But while you're here, we hope you like it. And I was thinking, wow, I haven't even started working here, and they're already planning for me to go because they say, the good ones never stay. And I don't know, I just have a soft spot for a place that has a little bit of a, inferiority complex or whatever, and I didn't want to ever want to be the person who left. I didn't want to do that. I'm proud of where I live. The news is no less real there than it is in New York. I don't need to have that thing, Mitch Albom is a writer living in New York under his name, to be validated. And meanwhile, I think I live amongst some of the kindest, most charitable, and most resilient people in the country. And I don't know how old everybody is here, but if you're over, 70 years of age, you might remember that there was a time that city was the backbone of this country. And we wouldn't have made it through World War II without the auto factories producing virtually every tank and everything that had to do with that war. And when this was a country when people actually made things and didn't just service things, Detroit was symbolic of exactly that. And just because we became out of fashion doesn't mean that we deserve to be the armpit of America and the butt of a bunch of jokes. And this guy, I don't know him, but whoever he is, Anthony Boudrain, he's a chef of some kind, came in and did some story and called us Chernobyl. This is America, okay? This is one of your cities. You don't do that to your own country, and blow in and say, yeah, the place looks like Chernobyl. Thanks. Come again, So I have no intention of leaving there. I'll die there, and I'll be proud to do it. And, if any of you ever come to Detroit, just stay a little longer than 24 hours, and you'll see what I'm talking about. So, yeah.
One more question.
Thank you.
Sure.
Hi, my name is Chrissy. I know that you've probably heard lots of people telling you, oh, your book just changed my life, and I know they changed mine. But I wanted to know, what's the most rewarding thing you've ever had someone tell you, be it that it's like from someone you help with a charity or a fan or something?
Wow.
Good question.
Wow.
We'll have a little intermission while Mitch thinks yeah. about this. And
I don't know. I mean, every kid in Haiti, when I get there, and these are kids who I remember sitting in people's laps, and every kid in Haiti talks into his chest when they're shy, and they're always shy when they're bought in. And to see these kids who they had their stomachs out and they're malnourished and they had all kinds of skin diseases, and I remember when they were sitting on whoever's lap when they came in, and now when I go down there, if it was 2 years later, I get out of the van that would drive, and they come running up and they say, "Mr. Mitch, Mr. Mitch," and they tell me about atoms and neutrons and protons, because that's what they're studying in school. I don't know how you top that kind of a feeling. You know, they don't even say thank you. They don't. I'm the one who's saying, you know, I'm just so grateful to see, you know, these are lives that are really being changed or saved in some cases, and that has to be the most rewarding thing. But there are many others. I've been the most overly complimented person for years. People saying, like you said, you know, you changed my life. I didn't do anything. I just told some stories. Most of the time, I was quoting other people, you know. And I say to people who read Tuesday with Maury, you know, and they call me Maury, I said, I was the stupid one. He was the smart one. I was just writing down what he said. I have to learn those lessons myself every day, and I still have to remind myself of those lessons every day. So the compliments I often feel uncomfortable with, because I don't feel that they're warranted, but the children down there are that everything I see about them is rewarding. Everything. And one day I'm going to see them walk down an aisle with a college degree, and that'll be the most rewarding of all. Thank you all. Those I didn't get to answer your questions, I'll meet you outside and try to answer them in person. It's very kind of you to come out here tonight and to sit through this. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. We'll be signing books outside in the lobby, right?
In the lobby.